your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield.
How you doing today, Charlotte? Okay?
I'm doing fantastic.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about a very serious subject today. We've got a full nearly an hour to talk about Ferguson, what happened up there in Missouri. And it started on August 9th, and it's pretty well winding down now. And a young man was shot by a local policeman, Darren Wilson, shot down Michael Brown. And it was over controversy about being in the middle of the street or whatever. Anyway, we'll get into more of those details. Are things sort of settling down right now, Charlotte, up there?
Oh, I really have no idea, George. I'm not anywhere near Ferguson. I'm 2 hours away.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, and my history with Missouri, I'm currently in Missouri, and my history with the state is that I moved from California to Texas, and that's where I met you. And then, you know, my life, I've had a pretty interesting life, and
sure.
I found myself in Missouri in 2009. So I've been in the state of Missouri. I had my children with a North Missouri man who's now deceased. So
well,
I have a connection.
Tell us a little bit about
area.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background, Charlotte. After say you went, where did you grow up and where did you go to school, and were you in the service? Tell our listening audience a little bit more about you.
Absolutely. Thank you, George. I'm a product of Northern California. And I joined the Navy, but due to the interesting upbringing that I had that I'm not going to go into detail now about, but there's some really good stories about that part. I was moved to the state of Texas when I was 15 years old. When I was 17, I was an emancipated minor and I joined the United States Navy. I competed, for my rank, for my privileges of pay. It was a totally egalitarian lifestyle. Between the ages of 17 and 22, I was an active duty Navy electrician's mate. Okay, those were like the real big influences there. And then I had a family. I got out of the Navy. I had a family, and I had a break of service. And then I went back into military service for my country, and for survival, to be honest, George. I joined the military for reasons I think people would be surprised to hear. I'm no hero, is what I would want to say straight up. But I joined the Army through the Iowa National Guard, OCS program, which is Officer Candidate School, okay? And I needed employment in the state of Texas. I was going to the University of Lamona. I was only a few hours away from my bachelor's degree. But I needed to go to Texas. And
right.
So I moved to Texas, and then I was there going through their officer candidate school, which I will say, Texas OCS, here's a shout-out to you if any of you guys ever hear this. You guys had a really huge impact on the person that I am today.
Well, who came in first academically in your class?
Well, me. But, yeah, see, that's the other thing. Yeah, oh, of course. Yeah, in fact, we can go back to the Navy. So I was put in an egalitarian system of competition, right? And I'm a product of affirmative action, Title IX, the whole 60s thing. You know, the adults in my child life were, wow, they were so incredibly fascinating to watch.
Right. So, and then you came out tops in your class on the OCS academically?
I think, don't shoot me, folks. I think I was OCS class 45, And okay. Yes, I was academic honor graduate, and I also had academic honors in the Navy. In fact, because I was given an egalitarian system of competition, like the playing field was basically fair, except peppered with racism. It was egalitarian, and I exceeded. And you know, I have a really clean human record. The system doesn't. I'm part of the system. You know, I'm a Navy veteran and, so I'm in Texas. I end up federalized. Let's just say I was on active guard reserve. Now follow me, if people that understand this, for the state of Texas, but the bill payer, and this is the money issue, George, the right. bill payer was the federal. Okay.
Okay.
And there were some fascinating legislation that went through while I was serving my state and my country, the United States, in the area of operation called U.S. Army South. Okay, that's like Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. And oh, George, I'm sorry. I went to get something on my. I turned towards my computer, and the thought just evaporated. I do apologize.
Okay, so you were down in. You handled some kind of a Haitian problem when you were in. You were part of the South Command. Tell us about that. Tell us about that, Charlie.
My very first interaction, okay, leaving California, which was extremely multicultural, extremely, and I have the yearbooks to prove it. Our faces are the faces of the world, George. I mean, there were people of every ethnicity on the planet, and where I was, well, that's not true. I'm sure somebody got missed, okay? There's like 180 countries and all this and that. But I'm just telling you, know, like genetically, if you look, the whole color of the rainbow of humanity was in that part of the country. Then I go to Texas. Then I join the Navy. Then I'm back in my element because I always give people the benefit of the doubt. But while I was in the Navy, I got to serve on a soccer team, and I got to play Haitian nationals, people from the country of Haiti. And that was they're Haitian, and that was my first interaction with that culture. And so, yes, I handled things that way, but I also interacted with them on the soccer field. I played games with them.
Right.
And they treated me so well. And here I was, you know, a 5'5" female on the front right wing of a soccer team, you know. Americans don't take soccer near as seriously as they take
football.
Now,
where did you play soccer there, in the Navy, when you're in the Navy?
Yes, I was on my ship's soccer team. It was co-ed, and I always wanted to play, you know. But also, I'm not going to lie, it was fun. I don't know why I played. It might have been Title IX or whatever, but, George, even one time I found myself in Italy. This is before I'm even the age of 22. I'm in Italy, and I'm on a soccer field.
Right.
And I'm my teammates are black, white, not a lot of Orientals, to be honest. But it's mostly black and white people, right? And my from my ship, and we're playing full on modern Italian people who've stayed in their locale, and they build their little communities around their soccer fields, and they treated me awesome. They treated me fantastic. I've been out in the world, is what I'm trying to say. And we're going to talk about Ferguson, Missouri, and thank you for helping me get this off my chest, so to speak, because
Well, that's good. You've had a lot of international experience, not in Glasgow. You were over there in Scotland, backing up nuclear subs, supporting
those. By the time of the age of 22, I had been stationed at in Holy Loch, Scotland, with the United States Navy on the USS Simon Lake, AS-33. We refit, rebuild, and otherwise patched up and dealt with the pressures of the Cold War, of the most forward-deployed nuclear refit facility in the war, the Cold War.
Right.
Okay, it was an isolating experience in Scotland. I was put in rural Scotland for about 2.5 years.
Now, that's where you met your husband, Matt, at the time, right?
Matt.
Or became your husband. Yeah, and then later on you would have two daughters,
right? I try to joke to people, and nobody gets it, but my friends from California are the only people that get this joke, okay? And I'm going to send the joke out. Shout out. Okay. I would say to people, Scotland, you know, they say, well, where'd you meet your husband? You know, women talk. And I would say, well, you know, I met Matthew in Scotland. And it occurred to me that it was probably in Scotland was the only place two very different cultures meaning Western California, you know, right there in the Bay Area, the Silicon Valley, and Midwestern rural agricultural, you know, quote unquote rednecks, those who labor and toil in the soil under the sun. Okay, that's what a redneck is. It's not something that means it's not white. Mexican, everybody's a redneck. Everybody, because the root meaning of the word redneck, okay, just means somebody who's looked down upon for on laborers. They look down anybody coming out of the field. It was an economic weapon. The upper elite who controlled the people who did the manual labor. Okay,
well, there is a physical description of a redneck too, though, because of the sunburn.
Yes, and here's where I would say stop. For everything that there is, there's at least four different perceptions, at least.
Right.
That's mathematically, that's how it's got to be. And so what I'm saying, what I'm trying to say is that, okay, and the word, okay, what being a redneck means, when I say it as a white woman, and I'm going to use all the racial stuff, I'm going to try to, you know, the white cracker woman, whatever, you know, redneck means you've labored in the fields under the sun, and the people that actually control the physical resources, they use it against you as a derogatory, and it kept social classes divided.
Right, right.
So everybody's redneck in that sense. We all come from rednecks. And the other thing is to be niggered. See, this is a language thing. Please try to follow me.
Right.
The language, the English language, the concept of color, okay?
Yeah.
Not everybody blushes red under the sun per se, but I've seen black people with sunburns. I've seen black people with their heels literally marched off them, okay?
Yeah.
I'm talking whole heels sliding off. They slid off of my black teammates. They slid off of my brown teammates. They slid off my yellow teammates. And the heels of all my teammates slid off, okay? We all bleed the same. So, and the idea that nigger, and I'm going to use this, and this is tough for me, George, because I don't use this word in public, but my perception of the word nigger as a 46-year-old woman with the life experience I'm trying to explain, it means somebody who rises up, okay, out of slavery. It says, I have risen up from slavery. And to be a redneck is also a badge of honor because they're saying, I come from rednecks. I come from nigger. Okay? And niggers is associated with slave. And isn't it a dark day when you're in slavery? It is a descriptive word that can be detached from the concept of race. Okay? And the other thing is racist has only come to be defined in one way. Racism only being defined one way. George, you were one of the people that always would talk about the isms. What is your perspective on racism?
Well, any system of any ism is a system of thought that is used to control people through. So I don't really subscribe to a race division of the human, community into races, because the DNA is so close that that's what you have to look at on a physical basis. Yeah, we have some differences, skin colors and things like that, but the DNA and all that is really, really quite the same. Now,
George,
we have cultural differences, of course.
George,
and there are, you know, but
cultural differences
are used.
I need to interject if you'll let me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for dominating, but
right
here's where I would say, like, okay, now, so let's say I'm the mother of a black boy. Okay, my child is adorable, precious. He is valuable to this society, to Western civilization. He is an important asset. Okay, and I as a mother of two beautiful white women, okay, they're women now, they're young women. One is a legal adult and has given me a grandchild, and the other one will be a legal adult in about eight months. Okay, so my nest is empty, so to speak. But I know that my black sisters, so to speak, the ones on the other side of the rainbow, they have to tell their sons, okay? This is what I'm hearing from my friends, people, okay, other fellow citizens. I am hearing my black sisters say, and they're not black, they're just my sisters. This is my homeland, okay? They're just my sisters. And my sisters are saying they have to train and teach a child, okay? Imagine this. Forget color. forget color. You have to train a male child that you frighten your authority so much that you better not move, not resist. In fact, you have to stuff your emotions immediately. Now, you're expecting this out of a male child, okay? And the teenage years are universal. The troubles we have with rebellion, with questioning authority of all types, parental authority, family authority, secular authority, lawful authority, okay, all this stuff. It's horrendous to me, George, that they have to teach their children, their boys, they have to teach their boys to interact with the police in a way that I know for a fact was not taught in my culture. However,
yeah, it's
California cops. Yeah. I want to do a shout out. Hold on. I was half raised. You know that I am an advocate for the California police. Okay. Those were my brothers. Okay. And they went into service to try to help in this melting pot that is America. And I have nothing against the police. I know for a fact that I see white men in Missouri, and I see white men in Missouri never interacting with the black race per se. And I don't want to call them race. But the color scheme, you know, it's like.
Well, we have to deal with the groups and describe them in certain ways to.
Not
to get
really. I could
across,
just say my darker skinned brothers.
Well, yeah,
they're
but
like
I mean.
The brunette
but,
over there.
You know,
it's far more.
Whatever,
fun.
You know,
I mean,
but
on.
We have to.
No, not
to,
whatever. I think vocabulary yeah. and language matters.
Yeah, it matters, but I mean, you've got to discuss it to where most people can understand what you're trying to get across, too. So, you know what I mean? You know, it may not be, you know what I mean?
George, slow down.
Yeah.
I guarantee you there are certain people that can understand me entirely.
Yeah.
Okay? Entirely. I guarantee you there are people that are going to hear this. And the other thing I want you to know is today, before we came on the air, George, I was on the phone with a service provider with my local media company. And I could tell, because I know genetics, because I was in the military and I've interacted with a lot of the Western civilized world, that he had black heritage, so to speak, or African-American heritage. He had African-American heritage, okay?
Okay.
You know those people over there suffering with Ebola and all this? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and so I challenged him. I literally said to him, did you know that in the late 1960s and the 1970s, my parents both advised me that it would be safer and prudent to and forbidden, frankly, to marry a black man or marry a non-white. Not only that, but I should try to stick to the Italian lineage or the Norwegian lineage, and I should also stay, oh, God forbid, I certainly shouldn't marry into somebody of a different religious faith. But then I was left in a world of nothing but diversity, and I mean, my neighbors are black. I have cousins that are African-American. I have, thank you, I just came in. Okay, I have... The language change. African American. We got
to. Yeah, you have to
black,
use certain descriptions of, you know, otherwise it's hard to communicate without saying something descriptive, you know, about people. That's
but
the point
those
I was trying
words,
to make earlier.
Those words, yeah,
I know where you're coming from.
Words have become talisman. You know, they become triggers.
I know, but I mean, if you're saying them from a right perspective. And you're not mean-spirited about what you're saying, you're trying to resolve things, then people will accept it like that, see? You know, the descriptions are not that important because it's what you're trying to get across and the ideas are more important. And if they're filled with love and forgiveness and trying to resolve some of these major conflicts between different parties and groups and whatever, you know, it will be well received.
Well, let's face some facts about American history. Missouri is part of the South, George. There was segregation.
Well, the southern part
and
of it
different
is.
Different theatrics
isn't it? Yeah.
Played out in South southern United States. Okay.
Yeah.
And the theatrics that are going on right now in the Midwest, the heartland of America, is that the remnants of generational segregation are truly coming to an end. Everybody's finally figuring out we're all economically and educationally bound together.
Right.
And I want to do a shout out to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, because I saw a picture of him in the paper, and he was on the street registering the citizens of Ferguson, Missouri to vote. Okay?
Yeah.
It's huge. And the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, George, the population is like the area, and I did some research. Ferguson, Missouri is not in the municipality of, if I understood correctly, it is not in the municipality of St. Louis, okay? Now, it is part of the, and if I understood even better, it's not even in St. Louis County, it's in St. Louis County.
Okay.
Have you figured out the geographics?
Yeah, I've looked at some of the demographics a little bit so far.
Well, geographically and demographically, where?
Yeah.
Can you give us a description that's better than I'm doing?
Well, it's a city. It's governed. The mayor would be Mayor James Knowles III, of which I don't think we've seen much of during this crisis. But anyway, it has approximately 21,000 residents. It's in the north-northwest area from the Central Business District of St. Louis. St. Louis, the general area, is much larger than the East St. Louis. East St. Louis is much smaller. The main part of St. Louis is west.
And I understand, George, that part of East St. Louis is also in Illinois, the state.
Yes. Well, yeah, East St. Well, the river divides the two cities. East St. Louis is Illinois, and West St. Louis is Missouri. But anyway, this city, in the year 2000, it's had a dramatic change, predominantly white in the year 2000. And today, according to the last census at 2010, which is 4 years ago, it's about two-thirds black and about a third white at this time of this event, this shooting that occurred. So, and then there are some smaller groups of Asians and Hispanics and things like that. But
that's the diversity of Ferguson?
Yeah, Ferguson right now is about 68% black and about a third.
Why were they advertising the 90% plus racial divide?
Well,
were they typing the number? I got bad information, my friend.
Well, no, that was an estimate. 2010 census is what I'm telling you now. That's actually a census. Okay, it's probably changed.
Point of 90% black?
No, what I'm saying is in the year 2010, according to the census, which is pretty accurate, it was 68% black and about 31% white. Now, that's 4 years ago. See, the census was 2010, so 4 years ago, you've had a change occur also. So it could be even more black than the 68% right now, but probably not 90%. I would not think it changed that much in 4 years.
You know what's going to be fascinating is the documentaries that come onto the Internet.
Yeah.
We're all connected through this technology. It's going to be fascinating when the long-term stories of Ferguson come forward. Everybody needs to be heard in this, regardless of our
that's,
our perspective.
Yeah, we were talking earlier.
Or our color.
Yeah, the big problem with this thing is that they did not release information that they should have as soon as they had it in their hands. I think it would have diffused somewhat the problems and the confrontation that developed from the activists and protesters. They had in their hands this video of him in the convenience store with the cigar incident. They did not release it for several days, but they should have released it immediately. They had information that Darren Wilson had been driven to the hospital by the assistant chief of police, and he was beaten up. Now, that's been released from the top brass of the police department. They did not release that either, which they should have done immediately. And they also got Dorian Johnson was with him on the street that night. And Dorian Johnson's story conflicts with other things that later on would arise from people, from video tapes and things like this. But Dorian Johnson testified he was trying to give up when he was shot down by the policeman. And also, I think he was stating that he shot him in the back, which is not the autopsy shows Michael Brown to have been shot 6 times, twice in the head and 4 in the right arm, basically. So anyway, that's
in the neighborhood where I come from, and this is a big neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
We would say this to each other.
Yeah.
You weren't there. We really don't know what happened.
No, we don't. We don't. And the real now there was a video that was secured by the media and published, and it shows a shot out the window, someone's window that's living right there across from where his body is laying in the street, and they let the body lay there for 6 or 8 hours. So
I want to say this, we have no
EMS vehicles around of any photographs that I've seen either. See, that's funny, you know. But anyway, there's this video that has been secured, and you know how the low level sometimes two people talking with around a video camera that will get into the camera microphone.
Well, we know don't we?
Yeah, it has two people, right. It has two people talking. Yeah, right. Anyway, it has two people speaking about what had just occurred minutes before, and they actually reinforce what the officer and what the police department is saying. And they're saying that they're actually saying that he bull rushed earlier on. There was a confrontation at the police window or when he was trying to get out of the police car. The policeman and Michael Brown had a confrontation. There may have been a shot fired. We don't know for sure yet. Then Michael Brown ran down the street. Evidently, the policeman regained his weapon and told him to freeze. And then at that point,
fear stepped in and God intervened. I just know everything you're saying. I just going to preface it with this. Media in the visual world and the way it can be rolled out with written articles and, like you've pointed out, the release of timely information that the public deserves, okay?
They should have gotten it sooner than they did. But what happened then, the people were under a misconception to a degree. We still don't know for sure, the details from that point where he ran off to the point where he's laying in the street dead, see?
George, let me make one point clear. I want to make one point clear before we go a moment forward. I should have said this at the beginning. Please, I'm going to stop you here. Right now, this is 2014, okay? Fact check me, people. I'm under the impression from the educated black males that I've seen in the media that – and I could be wrong, but check me, that right now in 2014, George, one of every three black males, darker-skinned males, are brothers, the darker brothers, okay, they are disproportionately, right this moment, more frequently killed by the police, and I'm sure it's regional, folks, we can get into the weeds later, they are incarcerated at a rate that is disproportionate. They are also sentenced to longer. This is all proven, George. We're tracking it through. We know these as facts, okay? I reported those statistics on Ron Paul Revolution Radio in 2008, okay? And I was shouting out to my friends in the far western United States, California, okay, San Jose, my neighborhood. I was shouting out to them, letting them know that, you know, hey, where you at? You know, I'm going to state straight. Ron Paul Revolution was vanilla white. There was one of my darker brothers was there, and I actually got up. I was giddy and hugged him, okay? One politically active man of a darker skin tone was there. Everybody was fluffy white.
Right. Well, you know, there was a Colin Diggs, who's out of Philadelphia, helped us on that on the Fukushima conference, and he's a black man out of a black young man out of Philadelphia, and he's right there, you know, with the Ron Paul people and everything else. So I think, you know, Ron Paul was a greater friend to that community, so whatever you want to call them, the dark community, than the other people, you know?
And George, you know what? You
because he really cared about rights, freedom and
that's
rights
right.
and
natural
liberty.
Natural rights. You know where
that's
I learned
right.
about
and
natural
that,
rights?
And that covered everyone no
I
matter what they
you,
look
George
like.
I learned it from you, George Butler.
Yeah.
You were the human influence. You were the figure in my life. You taught me about human rights. You taught me about natural rights.
Natural rights.
You
that's
taught
it.
Me about individual rights. And you taught me those things in the 90s, George. So please, let people hear the what is important about those rights as viewing us rather than as groups. Like there's an orange group over there and a purple group over there and a magenta group over there. No, we're individuals. Each one of us are children of the greater creator.
Right. And they're using the Democratic Party and Republican Party and so forth to divide us and keep us divided and against each other. That's what's so tragic about
it. Because it's an economic war.
That's right. But just remember, like we did the in the Fed rallies in Houston, three of them, we could not attract any liberal Democrats down there with us because they didn't like Ron Paul's politics. But they should have joined in for the greater good of reforming the Fed or at least auditing it or minimum of audit at least. But we couldn't get them to move on it, see. So they kept us divided, you know, along those lines, see.
Well, or at least that's what they showed us in the media. Who knows?
Yeah.
We haven't. I haven't been over to talk to a neighborhood of, you know, I haven't been back home in my neighborhood, George. I haven't been back home in my neighborhood to talk to my friends about this stuff.
Now
I don't know
what's
going on there.
Yeah. Now, getting back to this, the shooting again in the street, this video that was secured with these two low voices, low amplitude or low volume voices, were saying that he did bull rush him. Now, they're using the term bum rush. That's misnomer. He was bull rushing him evidently before he died. Now, we don't know. There was a shot in the top of the head that would indicate he had his head down running towards the policeman, possibly. But there was also a shot through the eye or in the area of the eye, the right eye.
George, when they drop, when bullets fly, it is such a rapid moment.
Yeah.
It is the most horrifying,
frightening
human experience.
Right.
And you're breaking down what happened in sheer seconds, not even seconds, just a fraction of
right.
The world thunderclap, and it's the world is another.
This happened in just a matter of 3 or 4 minutes, the final confrontation. And what
the world
changed
there. After that for so many of our sisters and our brothers, and my heart goes out to the
now,
to the people that are suffering emotionally over this.
Right. Now, Eric Holder, who has suffered under, I think up in Philadelphia somewhere, he was stopped by some policemen that when he was a prosecutor, I think a federal prosecutor, because he's black, they searched his car, and he thought it was humiliating, you know. So he went in later and tried to cool it down some and talk to a lot of people one-on-one and so forth. But the problem with this early on was that there were a lot of people from outside that came in, and I believe to do looting, see, and to do criminal acts and take advantage of the protests and so forth. And the police overreacted at times with tear gas, but it was CS gas, Charlotte, just like they used in Waco.
Okay. Yeah, I heard that stuff wasn't supposed to be used. I don't know. Someone needs to verify that. That's got access to the damn manuals and all the right numbers and codes. Is
they're
tear
different.
Gas authorized to be used? Have we as the people said, that's the tear gas you can use for crowd control? George, let's talk about the 90-year-old Nazi survivor.
Right. Yes, that's right. On Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman in downtown St. Louis there found an older woman, 90 years old, that was protesting about the whole, in general, I would say, the Ferguson problem of use of force and the military and martial law type stuff. But also she had an angle on Palestine, you know. She was actually for the Palestinian freedom movement or question. And she was saying that the police chief of Ferguson had trained in Israel on crowd control tactics and methods. We don't have that vetted totally yet, But we do know after researching this, since we heard that on Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now!, that there has been a tremendous training of many, many police forces and so forth in Israel by the Israelis over the last few years since 9/11. So we do know that that is a fact. Now, we don't know how many of those police officers from this area or from St. Louis area participated, but we'll do some more research on that. So that's not fully vetted. We're just going according to this 90-year-old woman. You can find that on Amy Goodman's site, that interview. So that's what
yeah,
came
and,
out of
it. And all I can say out to my wonderful fellow citizens of this wonderful nation is that be careful. Don't let the buzzwords trick you. The article is entitled Holocaust Survivor, and there's right. evidence, or apparently, somebody's checked this, but that she moved to England and got away. She's German-born Jew, as I understand it. And already, George, people are calling her a self-hating Jew when she's yeah. just not a Zionist. People yeah. Don't understand about Zionism.
Yeah, we've had a series of programs that have fleshed out many things, and I think that the general's son, Miko Pelid, had some good points to make. His father was a hero of Israel, of the establishment of the state of Israel, and he became a general in the army, U.S. The Israeli army.
1947 time
yeah.
frame.
Yeah,
after World War One, right?
Yeah, from then forward into the 60s when they finally consolidated their government there in Israel after the Six-Day War and all that, see?
Oh, where the USS Liberty was attacked to try to drag us into that, right?
But
we have survivor's testimony.
Miko Pelid's father says that he broke with the leadership in Israel when he realized that their goal was to drive the Palestinians out of Israel. Now, that's what happened on General Pelid and his view of the top leadership of the state of Israel when he finally realized that they were set and their goal was to drive the Palestinians out. And Miko Pelid's sister even did research in this area about the schools in Israel and found out they were very biased against the Palestinians from the beginning. So that's something to think about, what's going
on.
Well,
George,
there's
evidence in the historical record of our country and Western civilization that the reason why that happened.
Yeah. But the term that you need to look up, and this is something for our listening audience to look up and do research on. If you look up the term labor Zionism, that's really what you need to look into, because Edwin Black wrote a book called The Transfer Agreement, and he's a Jewish writer, very well written writer, very well thought of. But in this Transfer Agreement book, he was castigated, and his family turned against him because he revealed that the labor Zionists within pre-Nazi Germany and the Nazis created a transfer agreement to transfer Jews out of Germany. And to resettle them in Palestine. And so, and then, of course, they got their money and some of their assets as they were transferring them out. So it was people, you know, made a lot of money, too. But anyway, Edwin Black's close friends and his family turned against him until finally they realized a number of years later that he was right. And then they re-embraced him, brought him back into the family, into good graces. But anyway, the labor Zionist movement was the one primary movement coming out of Germany that influenced the establishment of the State of Israel more than any one thing. And then in the 60s, it began to change with additional political parties that broke off of that and so forth. But it was actually a socialist movement, and it was a very strong socialist movement. In Israel, and it's been broken into. There's several political parties now in the state of Israel. But anyway, that
can I ask you a question?
And
I'd like to say this. You know, it's kind of like Lion. You know, of Zion, save the Jews. The religious Jews are not Zionists per se. They're like all of us. Nobody's one way or the other. There are Jewish people that exist that are culturally acutely aware of what Zionism is. and we're ignorant of it.
Well, it's a political movement.
Let me ask you this. Can you have Christianity? Hold on. Am I right or wrong, true or false? Historically, is Christianity and Zionism at odds with each other, dating back to World War I?
What you have to say is Zionism is a political movement, and Judaism is a religious faith and movement. Okay.
Not an ethnicity.
And actually,
in greater ancient history, they might have been an ethnicity.
Well,
but
you have to,
German.
You have devout Jews that or will not subscribe or participate in the overall system of political Zionism. See what I'm saying? And because they reject it, see? It's not clear cut. Not every Jew you meet is a Zionist, and not every Zionist that you meet subscribes to Judaism, if you know what I'm saying. There's a political divide here and a religious divide.
And an economic divide.
Yes,
it's economics in the end. And see, George, this whole thing about
what
Zionism.
What they did with Israel was establish, I believe, a static aircraft carrier to threaten those oil producing Arab countries to continue the oil production to the West that the West needed for their industry. That's basically, I think, one of the major reasons to establish the State of Israel. Then the problem with it is that because the Arabs had been there for so long, then they resented that, and then they came in conflict with this new State of Israel, of which was it was created by UN and things like this, and it had British ties from the very beginning. When you say Israel, you have to say the City of London. You can't disconnect the two. And you get into big money and big finance, but you can't say that all the financial people in the world are just Zionist or Jewish or all that, because there's all kinds of people all over the world that fall into all of these different into these different categories. But it's that supremacy idea you had, Charlotte. What did you call it?
Supremacy thinking.
Yes, it's supremacy thinking. If you start using those kinds of ideas. If you're religious, you would say men trying to be God. If you're secular, you would say supremacy thinking or something like that. But it has to do with psychopathic types of people acting out those.
Well, can I? I agree.
Their types of idea. Yes, they
but
are.
They're also families, George. Let me say something real quick. My idea as a modern 46-year-old woman is that Zionism, in my cultural eyes, looks like the relationship between the person that held the advantage over the laborer who had son on their, the redneck, that relationship, that economic relationship and the derogatory and the struggles that they faced together and all that stuff. Zionism is in that relationship. It's also in the relationship of the concept of slavery or nigger, you know what I'm saying? See, the reason why I don't use the word nigger is because I've seen it used in every context. I've been in the presence of my darker skin brothers who I've seen them joke about the nigger word, and the nigger word for them meant I rise out. This is, this is where I came from. It was a term of endearment that I didn't have.
Well, but I've seen.
An indentured servant. Yeah. I descended from the rednecks.
Well, I've seen, though, some of the black friends that I have, they'll use it as a derogatory term, using it to describe other black people.
Or to describe slavery.
Yes. But they'll use it in a derogatory way to describe other blacks. It's sort of like a white man saying white trash, see?
Or
they'll use that
redneck.
Other term.
Or for some years, George, I was on
online, and I met a woman
who was from New Jersey, and she literally did not get my joke. And so I explained to her what my version of a redneck was, and we ended up laughing in the end, okay?
Right.
This is important. Not everybody in the United States knows what a redneck is. She actually, seriously, I don't know how it's perceived outside of my neighborhood.
Yeah, but here's the way that I would perceive it in today's contemporary. You have your own view of that, okay? But in today's Austin, South Austin, Texas type of thing, whether you're talking about a liberal Democrat or very conservative person, a redneck is a derogatory term, meaning a very low class person that they're working people, they're very common people. But they're also discriminatory and they're on the racist side. Okay, that's the way that the general term I would think would be described in today's community and world. Okay.
In the worst case scenarios.
Now, one example of this, when you're talking about...
That's why... You might be a redneck, George. Hold on.
Well, these redneckers...
That's why the comedians came into the culture. And, you know, we had the whole, you might be a redneck phenomenon. Okay, that's a shout-out. That's a artist's way trying to, you know,
that. An example of this is 1970, I went in Divider, Texas. The Chamber of Commerce was in a portable building at that time. There was a lady that headed up the chamber, had her feet up on the desk and reading the newspaper. Okay? I looked at her and I looked at the newspaper, and on the front page was a cross burning of the Red Dragons of that KKK area, local area of organization. I was doing a housing survey for a big investment company out of Houston. Okay? Horn Investment. And I talked to her for a little while, and I drove around the city, and I quickly concluded that we wouldn't want to build any housing here. See what I mean? Later on, I kept track of it and looked at Vidor, Texas, and there were many murders of black people that tried to move into so-called government housing that they had there, HUD housing, FHA type of housing. And these so-called redneckers, racist, a white racist in there, and backed up by the Klan, see, would go in there and murder these black people that were trying or had effectively moved into some of those apartments. This kept going on even when Cisneros was head of HEW, okay? And so that was into the 90s, I believe. I've forgotten exactly the year he was head of that. So this is not something that was 30 or 40 years ago. But in the South, still today, you have people that hate the blacks, you know, with a vengeance, and there's no reason to do that. But it's part of the South, and it's part of the rednecker, racist community that still resides in places in the South. And so Vidor is an example. They've come a long way probably since, you know, the problem they had in the 90s. I hope they have. But it was a prime example of a city that went out and killed blacks. Now, in my research for this program, I was doing some research on Wikipedia and ran across a riot up in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. And because of a problem with a man, a white lady, and with a black man in an elevator, that escalated, like maybe he had, you know what I mean, abused her or something. That escalated to a full-blown riot, and they burned down this large area in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That
you
had
mean
some
white people riot, George?
They went in
as
there,
food,
Charlotte, and got
property?
Guns and burned
You're
down.
You're joking, really?
They burned down the whole black community almost and killed quite a few people. This was 1921. So I'm just trying to bring this up as an example as to what,
you know, why that's probably why Waco
African Americans, or however you want to describe them, black Americans or whatever.
Well, look
have
at
been
Waco, George. The government didn't hesitate when the Christians stepped out of line that time.
Oh,
they went
yeah.
in and annihilated all those children.
Oh, Charlotte, there was another point that I also discovered that was
Waco.
Huh?
Don't forget Waco.
Yeah. Waco, but there was another a little bit of information that I discovered, too, that was a bit insightful. I was looking at cotton. You know, cotton was king in the South, okay, before the Civil War and after the Civil War. The Confederates tried to withhold it and burned many millions of bales to try to create an artificial shortage so that the British would be more helpful in supporting the South. But it didn't work. But anyway, after the Civil War, there were plantations that were abandoned, that were taken over by Northern operators, but there were other plantations where the Southern growers were in demand to grow cotton because the United States, the Union, needed that for revenue, see? And so these plantations that had started up again, and cotton was king in the South, they've just hired on these former slaves, okay? But one of the things I picked up that was interesting and really distressing and saddened me, depressing, was they would not let them leave the plantation without a special pass. Can you believe
that's
that?
That's called liberty. That's not called freedom. That's called liberty.
But they had
there's
to have.
There's a distinction between liberty and freedom that people need. My fellow American
but,
citizens.
But they wouldn't. They wouldn't let these former slaves off the plantation unless they had a special pass to leave.
That's not freedom. That's liberty.
But anyway,
okay, that's law of
so
the sea.
I found that a little bit ironic that here we go, we're freeing the slaves, and then they're still controlled by these growers. These white growers from the north, see what I mean? And they wouldn't let them off without special permission, see?
Yeah, I agree. I need to know this, George.
So that supremacy thinking is on both sides, what I'm saying.
No doubt.
See, it doesn't matter if the northern growers or southern growers. The southern growers treated them as slaves. The northern growers treated them pretty close to the same way, in a way. You know what I mean? If they couldn't have freedom of movement, see? So what are we talking about here?
I need
here,
to know this, George. What from your perspective, you're going to be 70, right?
Yeah, I am. I am 70.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That was okay. So you've been around.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know what was your perspective of the outcome? Like when everything that you're describing, how did it really, you know, you're telling me the important history.
Right.
I want to know what's your perspective of how it all sort of brought us to where we're at today. From your neighborhood, what did the meteorite look like?
In what
that was a joke, George.
What way? Yeah, what were you talking about? From my birth or something?
Yeah, seriously, because
okay.
wasn't there, right? And
I'll
I'm
tell
not
you,
even from the south. I'm from from the west.
I can tell you, at an old family out of South Texas in Austin. And Tyler for five generations, I can tell you the way that we were, you know, is that yes, the family in Gonzales participated in slavery. The family up in the Tyler area, I think on some level we did there at Chapel Hill, which was wrong, okay? And if I had, been there, I wouldn't participate in that. But later, after the Civil War, and when the slaves, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the Civil War was more about states' rights and things than specifically slavery. Slavery became an overriding idea later, a freedom that was granted to the slaves, you know. But there was indentured servants also early on, you know. But anyway, when I was growing up, my father used the N-word in a derogatory way. I never used that word because any use of the word back when we heard it was derogatory. I went to school, and we started integrating the Austin schools in the 50s, the late 50s, and it was a graduated thing, okay? And our football players, who were the star backs, halfbacks, running backs, were all black. And I ran on a track team with black athletes. We won district one year. We won district one year, and the lead guy was black. The second guy was white, handing off to me, and I was white, and I handed it off to the guy on the last leg, and he was black. So we had a black leading off and a black finishing it, and we won district. But it was a team of two blacks and two whites, and we were the fastest people, and that's who put us on the team. See what I mean?
Yeah,
it wasn't. It wasn't what you looked like. It was how fast you could run. Today, many of these teams are idolized. The black players are idolized by white fans. See,
and they've affected white culture.
Yeah. So and they've been successful in sports, and more power to
it's
them.
More
you know?
Than that. It's more
yeah,
than that.
Yeah.
We don't have to defend them. They're actions for themselves.
But anyway, what I'm saying is
I want to ask you a question, though, George. Do you think that could be where Title IX, the ideas that ended up in California in the 60s, do you think that's where Title IX could have came from? Where did Title IX come from?
I don't know.
What about affirmative action?
Well, That has been reversed somewhat here at the University of Texas. We have to get back to merit. You know what I mean? We have to provide people equal opportunity. But we have to provide people an equal opportunity, okay? But we can't guarantee equal outcomes. That's the problem, see? And we just, some people are more talented and smarter and sharper than others, and they're going to do better in a so-called free market society. The leftists, the far leftists.
This is all philosophy, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily reality.
Yeah, the far leftists have been conditioned into a more planned community or planned political thing and so forth. And so they want everybody to be leveled out and be the same, but we're not all the same. We differ with it, different intelligence and so forth. Now, the way that the blacks and the Hispanics were put down in Texas was through the money system. The money system was owned, all the banks in Texas were owned by the good old white boys, okay? And so that's how they control the economics through the banking sector. And it was fractional banking. They created these credits out of thin air. But they controlled everyone, no matter if you were white, black, Hispanic, or whatever. But they discriminated. These white bankers would discriminate against the minority groups in Texas because they favored the white borrowers. And so it was an economic thing that kept these people down.
Now,
what I support is opportunity for people that have good ideas, whether they're black or Hispanic or white. The ones that with good ideas, the viable ideas, should be able to secure the loans. And we talked about community banks, remember?
Oh, yeah, we've covered, there's so much work, George. We're having a conversation. We stand on the shoulders of giants. We've got 8 years of archives of radio where we've went into great detail on these topics that have influenced our society and our culture and Western civilization, frankly.
Right.
This is a good Western civilization radio show.
We've got to call ourselves the secret truth
about Western civilization.
If the liberal Democrats, along with some of the conservatives, would wake up to the money problem, then we could actually benefit everyone with more liberty and freedom than we have today, see? But we've got everybody divided and hating and shooting each other on the streets instead of loving one another.
Well,
see what I mean?
You know, liberty is what you give to a child.
Yeah.
And we've all agreed that the age of adulthood is 18. Okay?
Right.
Until the age of 18, that child is on liberty. And after that child is an adult, and they are free in this country.
Okay.
Okay,
let's get back to a solution on this. We only have a minute and a half here left, a minute and 20 seconds. Okay, let's get back to solving the problem in Ferguson. I would propose, and we talked about this earlier, some kind of reconciliation type of movement in Ferguson. They need to establish a conference symposium. They need to invite the white policeman, the black policeman, Ron Johnson. He headed
open
up.
Mic.
They need the activists that were there, the people, the mother and father of Michael Brown, their grandmother. They need to get up and they need to talk this out. And they need to establish
a
new
understanding.
They need
to everybody, not the media.
Right.
Let them have a community moment.
A town hall reconciliation of their differences in a town hall type of format meeting.
And
they need to do that as soon as
the good people of our country will do everything we can to help.
Right. So that's what we're proposing. We talked this over, and I think that would do more good than anything else. And we did this way back when I was at Fulmore High School. We had problems with the Hispanics and the whites fighting and all that. And we got up before a student body.
George, you know, can I just tell you something? In the media world, you could have been just cut off right there. We had problems with the Hispanics, and end of, and you could have been maligned for saying we had problems with Hispanics.
Yeah. But anyway,
let's be in context. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, there was problems between the Hispanics and the whites.
Yeah,
so
but
we solved
problem,
it.
You could say between the white people and the Hispanics, or something, between the whites and the Hispanics,
Whatever.
Like that.
Yeah,
but
anyway,
when you say problem with the Hispanics first?
No, no. We had problems between the Hispanics and the whites fighting. See.
Okay. I know, but you could sense that a little different, and it could be a little better.
Anyway, we're pretty well at the end of the program, and I want to thank everyone for listening, and tune in to thesecrettruth.com, and I'm George Butler, along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Thanks for letting me divulge my language.
And we meant whenever we use those N-words, we mean it in a good way, and we love everyone in the country. Okay. Thank you.
Love you, George.
Charlotte.
Bye.
Bye-bye.